On this episode of Big Boys Don't Cry, we discuss the film Lars and the Real Girl. You don't have to have seen the film to enjoy the podcast. As you know, we talk about a whole bunch of other stuff and it's good fun. But if you do proceed without having seen the film, you should just be aware that there are a couple of gentle plot spoilers. Enjoy.
Hello, hello.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. It's the day after the royal wedding, so obviously everything just seems dull in comparison.
It is. It's royal wedding Boxing Day.
Yeah, when I need to go and have a boxing match with someone to make myself feel good.
All we've got is leftover swan to eat. Got to cook up a swan curry.
Swan sandwiches. Why is it called Boxing Day? Is it because you box up all the rubbish and put it out by the bins?
I think it's to do with gifting. It's to do with gifting to like servants and people like that. So it's Boxing Day because you give boxes to people. That's what I was always told as a kid anyway.
Empty boxes. You give an empty box to the servants. That sounds appropriately royal and hierarchical.
No, it's with gifts in, instead of just being like, here's our empty Christmas gift boxes. So right. So everyone who sort of had to help with Christmas for the upper classes on Christmas Day then is given a gift in return on Boxing Day.
Oh, that's nice.
Is that I think that's the story behind it anyway.
That makes sense. So yeah, I'm gonna go and I've got to go and make my box for the servants soon then, because I didn't do that, and I don't want them to think that I've forgotten them. I want them to see me as a benevolent dictator.
Exactly, you know, you've got to put all of those leftover sort of Meghan and Harry masks and stuff like that.
Yeah, bits of bunting, some rotten old cake. They're not getting any of the swan though. That's just for
me. That's just for you. You want that oily bitter taste all for yourself.
Yeah. If there's one thing I like, it's a bitter bird. did you watch The Royal Wedding?
I did watch The Royal Wedding, yes. It was fascinating, and it was very different from any of the other royal weddings which we've had over the years.
Did you watch it live?
Yes, yeah, I did. I did. I was at a party at my brother's.
Oh, you went to an actual royal wedding party? Yes. Were you all wearing hats and like Union Jack suits and stuff?
I was one of those ball bags dressed head to toe in a Union Jack suit, singing God Save the Queen whilst crying.
God Save the Cream.
Yeah, God Save the Cream for the scones. But yeah, I was one of those guys. I hate those people, by the way. I try not to be too grumpy in general at people I don't know, but whenever you see that there's like a royal celebration and you get those people that camp overnight and are like dressed head to toe in Union Jack garb, I just think those people, like, they've got to be on a register somewhere, haven't they? Let's be honest.
Yeah, well, there's quite a famous one. His name's John something or other, and a few years ago, you remember when the fourth plinth at Trafalgar Square was like given over to pieces of art and they were like switching it up every week. I can't remember what it was, but me and friend of the podcast, Adam Molesky, had gone to have a look at it, and it was about midnight. I think we'd been on a night out or something. For some reason, we were in London late at night, and this guy was there, and he just came up to us and started talking endlessly to us about Princess Diana, and like he wouldn't leave us alone, but he wasn't like bad, you know? It was just like he felt like he just wanted to chat, and he was quite pleasant, but he was kind of just going on about Princess Diana for a long, long time. So, and that he's always become a bit of a legend since then. We know him as the Princess Diana man, but every time there's anything like any royal shit going on TV, he pops up and he's always there, like in front of the cameras. And he's like, oh, it's our mate, it's that guy that we met. And he was there at the royal wedding celebrations wearing like a black t-shirt that had a Harry and Meghan thing on it, and then his like Union Jack suit and stuff over the top. So yeah, he's great. But then I heard that apparently he used to go into Waterstones Piccadilly and talk the ears off the booksellers as well. So he gets around.
He gets around chatting about Diana and the royals.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a weird obsession for people, isn't it? You know, people get obsessed about different things. People get obsessed with different things. I was about to say obsessed by, and that is wrong. It's obsessed with, not obsessed by. If you say obsessed by, you're an idiot. You're the same person who thinks that it's called Sail Away and not Orinoco Flow. But yeah, people, it's strange what people get obsessed with, isn't it? Like I you know, constantly find myself having to explain to people why I like baseball. But I just find it really fascinating. And for some people, that's the Royals, and fair play to them. But at the same time, Union Jack suits, they are ugly as hell. They are one of the worst fashion choices you can make, even on a royal wedding day.
Yeah, and I find that the royal obsession is so extreme as well. So you like baseball, but when the new season starts, you're not going around wearing a baseball suit. A suit made of baseballs, ringing a bell like a town crier, going, "It is baseball time, friends! It is time for the baseball."
The bases have balled.
And I guess part of why I find it so irritating as well is obviously around Windsor there was this big clear up of homeless people being forced out. Whilst at the same time they were quite happy to be nice to all of these people who camped overnight for the royal wedding and listening to their stories about, "Oh, I nearly froze to death out here tonight." It's just leaves a really bitter taste in my mouth, that.
Nobody freezes to death in the UK, apart from obviously a lot of homeless people in the winter who are the direct result of us having a strange hierarchical capitalist society that literally forces them out. So yeah, that side of it is really, really horrible, actually. And you know, obviously to me it's a no-brainer. No way should we be footing the bill for this as taxpayers. You know, I don't believe in royalty. I think it's a concept that is completely outdated and bollocks and should be gotten rid of. But at the same time, I enjoyed watching the royal wedding, and Prince Harry seems like a nice enough guy, and I'm glad that he's happy. And there was also a black preacher who gave a bunch of anti-capitalist sentiment in his fire and brimstone speech. So I was down with that.
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is, because how much did the wedding cost? 36 million, was it?
Something like that, yeah.
And in comparison to most
six
budgets,
times the budget of the room.
Yes. But
that's how I measure anything that's above $6 million. Yeah.
How many times?
Oh, no,
that's
more, because that was dollars, wasn't it? This is probably 10 or 11 times that.
I'll give it a few years as Brexit continues and it'll be the same.
Yeah.
But the way that I see it is, like, 36 million really is kind of a drop in the ocean in terms of our overall expenditure. Yes, it could have been spent on other things, but in terms of the enjoyment of a national spectacle event, I think it's not really that much money. And so many people have gained enjoyment out of it. And it is, and you know, the royal family is a part of our institution. Lots of people have been saying, blah, 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 this is evil, this shouldn't happen. And I think, like, yes, the money could have been spent better, but I don't mind it so much in comparison to some of the other ways that this stupid government has frittered away millions and millions and millions of pounds.
Oh yeah, it's low, low, low down on, you know, on the list of crimes against economics, like giving a tax cut to millionaires and whatever, you know. That's why I can't really get worked up about it.
Yeah, and I've seen lots of people getting worked up about it online. It's like, oh, I don't care enough about it, you know. It's, yeah, the money could have been spent better, but at the same time it's made lots of people happy. Fair enough. And it was a really nice, refreshing wedding to watch as well. It wasn't stuffy, boring old white people.
No, music was good, preaching was good.
Yeah, Bishop Curry was great. Dropped in a reference to the Industrial Revolution, which I really enjoyed. I was like, didn't think we'd hear that in this.
Were you disappointed that my wedding didn't have that?
Yeah, where was the Industrial Revolution history lesson in the middle of your wedding, Paddy? I was really angry about that. I nearly stormed out and just like, this is a farce. This is a farce.
I feel like I owe you an apology.
and I like that he made reference to Martin Luther King as well. Which was great to see. And there was the added bonus of it clearly sort of mildly infuriating some of the older white people in the audience. Some of the more traditional royals, I don't think, were that impressed by it, which made it all the better. So
do you mean the 96-year-old literal walking skeleton Prince Philip?
Well, the funny thing is, watching his impression of it, I don't think he was that fussed. I think he quite enjoyed it. but there were some other people that they cut to who were clearly very unimpressed.
I don't want to be mean about Prince Philip because he is a 96-year-old man, but he looked like he had just risen up out of a grave. I mean, I doubt that I'm going to live to be 96. So if I do, yeah, I hope I look as good as that when I'm 96. But still, he looked bloody awful, like really scary.
He didn't look good, which is a bit worrying.
He looked like the Horned King from Disney's The Black Cauldron.
Oh dear. But overall, I enjoyed the Royal Wedding. I thought it was nice. It was refreshing, and it really infuriated the gammon, which mm-hmm. was really good to see. So congrats everybody involved.
It infuriated them, but they love it at the same time. So they're experiencing for the first time what it's like to maybe actually be conflicted in thought and to realize that actually some things are more complicated than a yes or no question.
Well, a lot of them still don't see it that way and think that she's people seem to think that she's some kind of Mancunian candidate sent to undermine the royal family.
I thought you were going to say Mancunian candidate then. Now that would be an excellent film.
I was about to drop a foot sport reference to you there, Paddy, but I felt better of it because I know that this is not my audience.
Was it one that I would have? Would I have got it? I might not have.
Did you watch the FA Cup final yesterday?
No, I did not. Okay. I know that Chelsea beat the Manchester United's by one goal. So well done to Chelsea.
Yes, in a spectacularly dull match as well.
Oh, no,
it was very very boring. But Manchester United did not win, which made lots of people happy.
Yeah. I suppose that's good because they're like the Red Sox. It'd be like if the Red Sox lost.
Well, they're more like the Yankees.
Yeah, actually, yeah, that's true.
In terms
Red
of
Sox
like
more
the
like Arsenal,
In terms of like a very sort of popular, successful team, but that also people don't like very much. Kind of like the New England Patriots and in the American football side of
that things. Also has global brand recognition.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. People sort of, there's this general dislike of Manchester United, but particularly at the moment because their manager is Jose Mourinho, the grumpiest, most whingy person in all of sport.
His coat's from Matalan.
And his coat is from Matalan. Quite a lot of different fan groups have a nickname for him as Shit Coat, which I think is always makes me chuckle when I see someone from another club calling him that.
No, I know who he is. Honestly, I'm more interested in football managers than any other aspect of the game. Especially, I've recently really started to like Jurgen Klopp because he looks great. He's really stylish. I've just ordered myself a pair of Klopp-style glasses, which should be arriving tomorrow. Very happy about that. But he's anti-Brexit. He's outspoken. He seems like a really good manager and that he gets the best out of his team. He just seems like a really cool guy. Yeah. And Mourinho just cracks me up.
I love Klopp because he's so over the top and so energetic about everything and so passionate about everything. And I think that's really needed in the game. Yeah, he's brilliant. But yeah, I dislike Jose Mourinho. And like quite a lot of people don't like Manchester United. I don't really like them, but I have a lot of respect for them and for Alex Ferguson when he was manager. He was one of the best football managers of all time. But I think Mourinho goes around things a lot more cynically. I've never seen a Mourinho side play interesting football. He basically kills the enjoyment of the game when he plays. when he manages a team, they always play in a very dour way, which I don't like. And so I'm hoping that he will leave Manchester United at some point so that they get someone more energetic in. Like
he'll
Ferguson.
Just fold into his coat. His coat will just fold on top of him. He'll roll into a ball and then he'll just roll out of the stadium and into the sunset. That's what's going to happen.
That would be incredible. I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So this is a nice weekend. The Royal Wedding, I think, was a nice distraction. And then following on from that, watching Lars and the Real Girl was quite a nice distraction and diversion too. But I realised that I actually hadn't seen it before. I mixed it up in my head with basically all of the other films that Ryan Gosling did around the same time.
So you were going into this movie thinking, wait, I thought he was going to be a high school teacher.
Yes,
drug problem,
exactly.
That kind of thing.
Which is also, yeah, I like that film a lot too. But yeah. So yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a pleasant distraction and a very, very interesting film that I feel like definitely didn't get the recognition that it deserved. It seemed like, it, from what I could tell, that it was critically acclaimed but didn't do that well at the box office. And it's not hard to see why. Because I think I, along with a lot of other people, thought it was going to be some kind of perverted sex film, because that's what you think when the concept is explained. And I can't think how else you could market it, really, right?
Yeah, you could imagine Adam Sandler's Lars and the Real Girl. and it would be
let's not drag Adam Sandler into this.
where it's about Adam Sandler and he gets a real girl, and Rob Schneider is, instead of Paul Schneider,
they're not related, are they?
They're not related, no, at least I hope not.
But Paul Schneider is kind of like the acceptable, nice, good version of Rob Schneider, isn't he? He always plays those kind of buddy roles.
Yeah, yeah. I really love Paul Schneider. He's recently been in a show called Channel Zero, which I don't know if you've heard of at all.
I have not even heard of that.
It's this horror anthology series released by Sci-Fi, and it's one of the most interesting and creepy shows around. And they basically kind of take creepypastas. Have you heard of creepypastas
before? Yeah, yeah.
So these basically online horror stories, the internet equivalent of telling scary stories around a campfire. And they take sort of like the core concept of one of these internet horror stories, and then they build a mini series out of it. And they've done three series so far. The first one was about a TV show called Candle Cove, a kids' TV show called Candle Cove, which doesn't exist, but formed this incredible creepypasta. And he was the lead in that. And it was a fascinating show. And each of the three series of Channel Zero so far has been phenomenal. I really highly recommend watching it. Anyone who likes horror, really check it out. It has a very different tone to any other horror TV show as well. It's very subtle and it's very atmosphere heavy, which is very different from a lot of other horror shows.
That sounds really good.
Yes, no, it's fantastic. Underrated.
Yeah, everything I've seen him in, I've thought he was really good. He was the brother in Away We Go, the sad brother whose wife left him. He was very good in that. And he was in the first series of Parks and Recreation and then left the cast, which was a real shame, because I felt like all of the other characters grew so much over the however many seasons that there were, that if we'd allowed his character that space to develop, it could have become really interesting. But I think he had something else on.
Yeah, and he was in Elizabethtown as the drummer.
Oh, yeah. Free bird. That's the best bit, when the bird catches fire and falls.
Yes,
on everyone.
I love that.
Spoiler alert. If you haven't listened to episode, it was about what, episode 20 we did Elizabethtown?
Yeah, something like that, wasn't it? And yeah, so he's great. I really like Paul Schneider, and he turns up a really good performance again this time. But this is another film where the whole cast is great.
Nobody lets the side down, with the possible exception of the woman who played Bianca. I mean, just so wooden.
Yeah, not a lot of expression in that performance, was there, Paddy?
No, she was just playing it pretty straight.
Oh dear. But yeah, so Lars and the Real Girl, for anyone who hasn't watched it, this awkward guy who's had quite a tragic life, he has problems with intimacy, and one day he orders a real doll, so like a lifelike doll that's supposed to be made for sex, but instead he treats
anatomically
it,
correct
at, yes but instead he treats it as a romantic engagement, effectively, telling people that he's met this person via the internet, who it's a Danish and Brazilian descent, isn't it, Bianca?
Yeah.
Who's a missionary, but who's also is also physically disabled, which is why she can't move of her own accord. And so that's
she's in a wheelchair.
Yes, and that's why he has to take care of her. And yeah, so it's this incredibly sweet movie made out of a an idea that could have been much seedier in the way that it was set up.
It could have been seedy, it could have been cheap, it could have been stupid. Like he said, I think we're conditioned perhaps by the Adam Sandlerism of a lot of comedy and romantic films to go into it thinking that whatever the central premise is, they're going to try and pull cheap humor out of it. And with this kind of film, it so easily could have gone down that kind of route and just been laughing at him and his delusions and making cheap comedy out of the real doll and making it, you know, sexual and dirty and stupid. And it doesn't do that at all. It's instead, what it does is it's a really, really interesting look at intimacy, community, trauma, mental health, delusions, all of these things packaged up in a sort of quite sweet and redemptive story, really. So I think it did very, very well not to ever cross that line.
Yeah, it really did. It's a fascinating film. In the and there's two ways that it could have gone badly. It could be that it goes down the Adam Sandler route, where
the Michael Bay route,
the Michael Bay route, where the real doll.
As our resident Adam Sandler apologist, I don't want to tar him with the Michael Bay brush.
Although I think Michael Bay, if Michael Bay was going to go down this route, he'd treat it kind of like Pinocchio, where she came to life. And it would almost be like a weird science type thing, which is a movie that I don't like very much, but has this kind of place in pop culture, doesn't it? Weird science.
Yeah, that's one of John Hughes's lesser efforts.
Yeah, and right. People still kind of love it, but I'm not really sure why, apart from for purely nostalgia reasons. And yeah, so you could imagine that at the end of Michael Bay's Lars and the Real Girl, she comes to life. Something explodes. They drive off into the sunset together to live happy ever after.
The scene where he's like holding her, walking into the lake, that would go on for 15 minutes of him just going, no!
Exactly. And yeah, so in that version, it would be like that. In the Adam Sandler version, it would be full of sex jokes and fart noises. There'd be at least a fart noise every 10 seconds, which
you'd
I think
walk
is...
You'd walk into the kitchen and Rob Schneider would be naked...
Yeah,
for no reason.
Yeah, and he'd be putting on some kind of offensive accent.
Yeah.
As is his wont. But yeah, so there's that way that it could go. But then there could also be like the overly dramatic, sad version of this, which had the humour entirely taken out of it. But there's a lot of humour left in Lars and the Real Girl. They really treat it, they're very careful with the way that they treat this film. But it is actually very, very funny. Even though there's all of this sad subtext to it, they really inject a load of humor into it, so it works so well.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I lolled at any point, but there are a couple of things that made me chuckle. But mostly it just felt lighthearted. And again, as you said, they're dealing with seriously large stuff, like the trauma of losing both parents at different times, you know, the way that people process intimacy, that kind of thing. And, you know, Paul Schneider dealing with his brother's delusions and mental health and that kind of thing. These are all really, really serious things that I think a lot of films would have been very po-faced about. And obviously to try and not do those in a serious way obviously can go wrong, can go very, very wrong. And I'm trying to think of other films that perhaps get it wrong and none are springing to mind. But at the same time, they must be out there because both of us have kind of approached it with the same thing as saying you could see how easily it could have gone wrong, but it really, really walks the line very well, sort of washes over you in a nice way and makes you just think, oh yeah, that's nice. That's nice for him. You know, and we understand that it's about how people process delusions and intimacy and all these kind of things, but ultimately because the community of the film and the small town all comes together, it ends up being almost like a feel-good film, doesn't it? Even though it ends with a funeral, which is no mean feat.
Yeah, and you're completely right that it feels like it is a feel-good film, and it is about sort of a town coming together to support one of its more vulnerable residents. And that's the way that it sort of goes in an unexpected direction, because the first time you watch this, you think that like there's going to be a real sort of ostracism of him because of what's going on. But instead, they kind of all band together around him in a way that's really, it's really interesting to watch. And they kind of accept Bianca into their society and into their community as a as a real person, which is really interesting.
There's no question of it, really. Like, there's a bit of kind of a few people who are a bit weird about it, but nobody at any point kind of really insults him, or it doesn't need to go to the tension of, like, again, once it's happened, you think that the whole tension of the film is going to be about people denying that she's real and that it's going to be about that. But it's not even about, it doesn't go down that route either, which I thought was really good too. The tension comes from his own inner struggles and from just how the community deal with that. And yeah, they all accept her, and they're like taking her to meetings and doing her hair and stuff. And it's really heartwarming, actually.
It is. It's really, and those are kind of my favorite scenes in the film, I suppose, are those moments where, she's treated as someone within this society. And yeah, it's just really fascinating to watch. And you kind of wonder, would that happen in real life? If there was a member of the community who was really, you know, not necessarily well respected, but well regarded by everybody, and they came from a family of people who were well regarded, would that kind of quirk be thought of in that way?
Yeah, and I don't think it would. And I also don't think you could set this film in a city either, because so much of it is about that kind of small town community. Everyone knows everyone. And there was a part of me that thought that this film was actually almost more of a treatise on the importance of small town community than anything else, because it just made you think, wow, everyone's been so kind to them. And there's a scene where Emily, who is Paul Schneider's wife, so his sister-in-law, is kind of, Lars is upset because Bianca has gone out and without him, because he's been taken out to some meeting and they've said that, like, he can't be like controlling her and keeping her around just for him. And she's yelling at him and she's saying, we're all doing this for her because we care about you. And it's like, and that kind of thing, that kind of unquestioning community caring about someone is, yeah, I think is actually quite rare in real life.
Yeah, and I agree, but I definitely agree that this would not happen in a city. If this kind of thing happened in a city, the extent of it would be that someone would just take a video of it and put it on Twitter and it would go viral, and then you get a BuzzFeed article about it, and they wouldn't really go deep into it very much, and then people would lol and put a little laughing face emoji, and then that would be it, and it would become like just a footnote of meme culture. And that's all it would be. No one would look into it in depth in real life, apart from the people who are actually close to that individual, if they knew about it.
Which maybe they even wouldn't, because city life is just so different.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, it's interesting to see. But at the same time, even though you kind of have those thoughts of, would this really happen in real life, you still kind of think there is the possibility that this would happen. And if a community was together enough, and they recognised that something difficult was going on in this person's life, you feel like they probably would try and support however they could. And so it's an interesting one.
It is, definitely, you know. And yeah, no point does it feel far-fetched at all, even though obviously it's a man who's in love with a doll, which is quite strange. It all feels completely natural, and especially because you have the presence of, it manages the presence of the other characters very well, especially Patricia Clarkson as the therapist, who only appears in a handful of scenes, but you feel like she really knows what she's doing. And of course she does at the end, when she says, you know, actually it's Lars who has come up with all of this inside his mind. He was the one who decided that that Bianca was ill. He's the one who has said that she's dying. It's not, none of the doctors or anyone else has said that. So she's just kind of carefully managed it within that and the community, and you think, oh, she's been the kind of genius behind all of it. And her performance is great, again, very, very straight and very quiet and understated and just generally very good.
Yeah, and I mean, you know how I feel about Patricia Clarkson. I think she's phenomenal. I don't think I've ever watched anything with her in that I haven't enjoyed, or at least enjoyed.
Underrated.
Yes, incredibly underrated. Wait,
isn't she in Boyhood?
Oh, is she in Boyhood?
Did you know that it took 12 years to make?
I did not know. That's incredible. It took 12 years to make. 12 whole years to make a movie. Wow, that is amazing. How many Oscars did it win? Did it win lots of Oscars? I bet it deserved lots of Oscars.
It got all of them, the full set.
Oh dear. But yeah, it's she's great in this. And it's a great movie. Is she in Boyhood though?
Is it her or is it someone else? I'm gonna have to look it up.
Let's have a little look. I didn't think it was her. Oh, it's Patricia Arquette, not Patricia Clarkson.
Yeah. My bad. So yeah, Patricia Clarkson, unbroken record.
Yes, not in Boyhood. Not in a movie that took 12 years to make.
Yeah, unfortunately. So she didn't get to win the Oscar for that one, but...
No. But yeah, it's, and the whole cast works really well. I did toy with the idea about whether to actually include this in Big Boys Don't Cry in general, because it's an interesting one in terms of romance, because you've got a romance between a man and an inanimate object, but then also the blossoming romance between him and someone else as this is going on.
Yeah, and I was super rooting for that. That was the most important thing. It really, really got me, because I think Margot, it was her character who just really, really just did it for me. I thought her performance was really, really fantastic, because this kind of, she's sort of coming out of her shell and they work together and everything. Yeah, she nailed it.
Yeah, yeah. And those kind of scenes in the office environment were really clever as well, the way that they treated them. It felt very genuine, in a way that sort of like small town friendships in work do operate, and those kind of quirks that happen in small towns, if you know what I mean, where you've got to put up with the weird guy, and you've got to sort of make the most of it.
The guy who shares your cubicle, who actually does look like Mackenzie Crook from the original Office.
Yes, exactly. And it kind of has parallels with with the American Office, with Dwight Schrute. That same kind of thing, where you sometimes do have these very bold personalities, and you kind of just embrace it when you're there, because like if you make a, you know, it might not necessarily be people that you would hang out with or sort of like communicate with necessarily outside of your work environment, but it's important to have those kind of relationships with people.
No, but that's life. You're sort of thrown together with people, aren't you? And the a really good scene, I thought, was when Lars and Margot sort of go on a date. Like he's still with Bianca at this point, but she goes out to her like school board meeting and he's like, oh, I'm free. And then she sort of like half asks him out and he agrees to it. And you're like, at that point, you're definitely like super rooting for them, and they go bowling and they're sort of going fine. But then a few of the other people that they work with show up, and then they're all like actually having a really, really good time. And there's the worry that they're going to take the piss out of him, but they all end up having this really, really great fun time. And you just say, oh yeah, that's nice. They've got that sort of aspect of community as well, where they're all just having a laugh in the bowling alley. And yes, that was quite nice as well.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite scenes in the film as well, is that little bowling alley scene. It's really, really nice to see. And again, it just feels like what I take away from this film is that kind of support. And it leaves you feeling so nice and warm inside, is that support network that someone has in place outside of, a regulated support network. There is this community that takes care of one another, and it's the kind of thing that you wish happened more in real life. Effectively, and it's really nice. It's a really nice thing to witness, even if it is only in a movie.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, in real life, a lot of people take that sense of community from faith and religion as well. And that was in this film, but it wasn't done too much either. But there are a few scenes in the church, and the church is obviously important to the small town as well. You know, they got the singing in the choir, and it's kind of implied that that is a good thing for the local community. But it's never really brought in so much that you think that it's actually like a theme. It didn't really need to be there, but it is a part of the community. So that was kind of dropped in there as well. It's a thing to make you think about as well, that so many people experience that through faith. But it's a different kind of community that brings the town together around Lars to help him.
Yeah, and it's one of the most important roles that faith plays in in Western culture is the way that churches of people are able to build that community standing together. It's one of, if not the most important thing. And you think about all the good work that churches do and that side of community does. And you're right that there is that slight element here, but it goes above and beyond that. Whereas although that's sort of like a place for them to congregate and a place to have that routine meeting of everyone together, what they do goes beyond simply being at church together and beyond the expectations of what a church would do in that situation. So it feels very nice, and it's like they've really stepped beyond what was expected of them effectively.
Yeah, definitely. So all that stuff kind of feels good, and it's well shot as well. It feels, I think they shot it in a bunch of different towns across Ontario in Canada, but it all looks good. It's all a very believable kind of small town, and you never really find out what anyone does for work or what the office that he works in. You don't know what the company does, but it doesn't really matter, does it? You know that they have to dress smart. It's probably insurance.
Yeah, it's generic office work, isn't it? It doesn't matter. It's the kind of thing where anyone who works in an office can look at that and go like, oh yeah, it's office work. It's fine. So it's cool. It's a cool movie. It's one of those films where it's a shame that it didn't do better commercially, I think, because there's a real like pulling power to it. It's developed a cult following, and at the time obviously critics liked it, and people in like the independent scene and sort of like the mumblecore scene enjoy it. It's one of those standout movies of that kind of environment, but it didn't get the recognition that I think it deserved, although it did get an Oscar nomination.
Okay.
Its screenplay got an Oscar nomination, but
I have this theory that any film that has a person's name in the title is never going to do as well as it should. And if you try and think of any film that has a name in the title, I bet you that kind of plays out.
Let's think about this.
So I haven't seen a lot of these films, but let me think of Dan in Real Life, which is a Steve Carell film.
Yeah, it's a very good film, that.
I Love You, Philip Morris. Again, that if it's got the first name and the surname, that's like, whoo, that's just a recipe for disaster, because it's like you're supposed to know who the person is, but you don't.
But also, I think a lot of this comes down to the kind
Jerry
of,
Maguire,
the kind
that was lesser a complete
heard,
flop.
That lesser heard movie, Jerry Maguire. I think it comes down to the kind of movies these days that use those kind of titles. So I think it is a lot of those kind of independent movies that go for that kind of title, where they tie an individual character to one of the themes of the movie, or like have an elongated kind of title like that. So it's not like so even biopics these days. Biopics previously used to be hugely popular. So like you look at films like Gandhi, for instance, uses his name, and that was hugely successful. But nowadays you get, they're called things like The King's Speech or The Darkest Hour, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Or was it called The Iron Lady, the Thatcher movie?
The Iron Lady, yes.
Yeah. And so they've kind of moved away from just naming the movie after the person in general.
Yeah, if they made Gandhi now, it would be called like Gandhi and the Hunger Strike big moment.
So I think it more comes down to the kind of movies that choose those kind of names, and the director of Lars and the Real Girl has directed another movie with the character name in it, which I think has done very well. So I, Tonya came out this year.
Oh right. I hadn't made the connection, and I think I've heard very good things about that,
and I think that has done very well.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I don't necessarily agree with your theory.
I think if you put I before it, that's like a get out, because it sounds dramatic and important, doesn't it? But again, I think people know who Tonya Harding was, and she's the only person ever to be famous called Tonya. So that I think has a bit more recognition than if it's just like a name.
Yes, but again, that comes down to what kind of movies choose that kind of naming structure it's indie movies that don't get a wide release and that no one really wants to see in the cinema.
And it's also been discussed recently in light of the film Lean on Pete, which I went to see on Thursday. It's very, very good. And there was it's based on a novel of the same title. And it's the name comes from the name of a racehorse in the film who is called Lean on Pete, and the character, 15-year-old Charlie, who works for the horse trainer and then has this kind of cross-country journey to try and find his family. And it's really, really, it's an amazing film. I highly recommend it, and the book as well, which would be in my top five novels. But apparently, yeah, the title didn't do well with kind of consumer insight, screen testing or whatever, because it just sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? Lean on Pete. But they couldn't think of anything to change it to, so they kept it.
Oh yeah, if that's the name of the book. If you change the name of the book, it means that then you get away from the people who read the book, who might go and see it.
Yeah, for sure. No one would ever make the connection if you changed the name.
Yes.
I'd have been like, what the fuck is this shit?
But yeah, so yeah, I don't necessarily... And another one recently as well that seems to be doing well, or that's got a lot of... support around it is Tully, the Charlize Theron movie.
Oh yeah, I've heard good things about that too,
which apparently is fantastic. I think
my theory only applies to films where it's about a fictional character, if it's a film about an existing person that uses their name in the title, that's fine. If it's a film about a fictional character with the name in the title, I feel like it's never going to get the recognition it deserves. But the only way to settle this is to make some kind of huge database of these kind of films, which I'm obviously going to do this week when I'm bored at work.
Yeah, you need the database, and then it needs to correlate to include all of the data surrounding what genre of movie and expected budget and expected revenue and that kind of thing.
Wait, I've got another one. Solo, A Star Wars Story. It's going to flop, I'm telling you now. No one's going to watch it.
Well, I don't think that the movie's necessarily going to do as well as the previous Star Wars films, because there's been a lot of chaos surrounding it.
Yeah. But I saw the trailer on Thursday, and I think it looks quite a lot of fun.
It looks a lot of fun. I want to go see it. I'm excited about it.
I will be seeing it.
And yeah, you know, like Spider-Man. Yeah. Deadpool.
Yeah, all of those guys, rubbish.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of other ones now.
I think Lars is a funny name as well, as we discussed last week. There's not many good Larses, are there?
No, there isn't.
Lars von Trier is obviously the worst. Deserves to get bitten by a goose, as you said in last week's episode. Lars Ulrich, the insane drummer from Metallica.
Yes. Lars Fredriksson.
Oh yeah, he's good.
He's good. But yeah, it's like a little niche indie name, isn't it? A quirky name.
Not that I can think of a better name for it. So, you know, what do I know?
No. The new title could be Promise I Didn't Have Sex with This Real Doll.
Yeah, you could just call it Dolls But No Sex.
Yeah, that works. That,
yeah. Oh, you guys, I promise it's not a sex thing, honest.
if they called it that, it definitely would have done better with in the theatres. Definitely would have.
Well, on that point, there is a scene between Ryan Gosling and Paul Schneider where they just have kind of the very briefest chat about sex, and it's like skirting around it, and he's like, oh, when did you feel like you became a man? Was it to do with sex? And he was like, yeah, maybe. And then it just kind of trails off, and you're like, is it about to descend into a sex bit with Ryan Gosling and the doll? And I didn't think the film was about to show it, but I thought it might have been just a little bit to explore his intimacy, but it didn't go there. And again, I appreciated that, because it wasn't necessary, was it? It still explored intimacy in a very, very interesting way without ever really having to make it sexual, which is an achievement.
Yeah. And I think if they had introduced that kind of sexuality into it, I think it would have really damaged people's responses to the film. I think it was super important that they steered clear of that kind of stuff as much as possible. which they did very well.
Yeah. And there are moments of intimacy between Lars and Bianca where it's showing them as if they were like a regular on-screen couple in any kind of romantic comedy film. Like they sort of go out on dates and they go for a walk in the woods and he's like singing to her and you're like, it's quite cute, really. And then when their relationship starts breaking down, or like Lars, obviously, he's just completely making it up, but it's like they're having arguments and stuff and he's yelling at her. And then the sister-in-law is like, oh, they never fight. But you can hear him like yelling at her upstairs, and it's like they play it out as if it's a real relationship, but all the time you know that it isn't. And again, you become, because it's portrayed to you on screen as if it's a real relationship, you then feel like you are part of the community around them yourself as well. So it's very good at drawing the viewer in that way.
Yeah, they do a really good job of making it. You kind of become captivated in it as well, and you start seeing it more as a real relationship, or at least you have that empathy for Lars as he sort of explores the degradation of this fake relationship. So you get emotionally involved in it all as well. And they do it in a really clever way. It works so well.
Yeah, I definitely felt invested in that. But at the same time, I also felt very, very invested in his relationship with Margot as well, and the tension between those two things wasn't huge, because obviously you knew that like it's not real, so at any time he could just kind of shake it off and be like, hey, I'm actually going to be in a relationship with a real woman now. But actually it's the story of his eventual getting together with Margot, even though it's not said, it's implied at the end when they're just like, do you want to go for a walk? I'm like, yeah, sure. So that his relationship with Bianca and his delusions are actually an impediment to that love story. But again, that's not kind of overdone either.
Yeah, exactly. It makes these tentative steps forward, I suppose, is the best way to think about it, in that everything moves incrementally, and you kind of reach this point where as the sort of tables shift, it doesn't feel too jarring. So as the relationship deteriorates and things like that, it doesn't feel like it's too much of a shock to the system as you're watching it. It all moves at a very flowing rate.
Yeah, and I think that's because they spend just enough time on each character and on developing each character, and seeing the character development is really good. And a lot of the problem with a lot of films, I think, is that they spend either too little time on a character before you're expected to massively care about some event that happens to them, or too much time where then the payoff isn't as great. Like it balances all the characters out very, very well.
Yeah. And again, it almost feels like an ensemble film, although you've got that priority given to Lars. Everyone else has such an important role to play and get such a good share of screen time, I suppose, between them, that you get to know sort of like the inner workings of everyone's lives incredibly well. It's just, yeah, it seems to work so well in that regard.
Yeah, especially when a lot of those relationships are things that aren't necessarily always portrayed well on screen, like the relationship with his sister-in-law. You actually get the impression that she really cares about him, and there's a level of interesting intimacy between them as well, and especially with her being pregnant as well. There's kind of that element of new life and rebirth there that's then thrown in as a bit of an overtone, but again, not overdone.
Yeah, and you're completely right about that it sort of portrays things that aren't necessarily shown in the film, because film always has a very difficult time portraying relationships that are going well in that kind of middle period. So obviously a lot of movies showcase someone getting into a relationship for the first time, or they showcase sort of like an established relationship that's on the rocks, be it for a comedic or a dramatic effect. But they often find it very difficult to portray a functioning relationship. And here they kind of showcase that, but also show the stresses that are caused by a bizarre external event at the same time, which is very carefully done. And like I said, it's very rarely done this well in a film. So it's nice to see that as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's very, very interesting on a number of levels. There are layers to it. It's a real... a real Ryan Gosling onion.
A goose onion.
A goose onion. A bitter onion. Not a sweet Maui onion.
No.
But Ryan Gosling's performance is obviously very, very good. Like, I mean, I'm a big fan of his, so obviously I think maybe I'm a little bit biased, but he's very, very good, and it's his face as well. His little facial expressions and the little things that he does, and his sort of his little smiles and his kind of his he does a lot of acting with his eyes as well, and the tash is really it really makes his face as well. He's very, very good in this very, very understated performance, and a very, very funny performance as well. A lot of the comedy actually derives from his understated physical humor, I think.
Yeah, you're right. It's a very this film takes a lot of care and attention, but there are these moments where he's able to sort of stretch his muscles from an acting perspective, and you're right that a lot of that comes from a physical perspective, and there's obviously this necessity for this, because if you're acting versus a doll, you can't have that intensity of performance purely from an emotional angle. You need that physical as well. It works so well. And there's all these very neat little scenes, like where he's reading Don Quixote to her and stuff like that. It's a really great performance. I think it's one of Ryan Gosling's best performances.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely up there. It's no La La Land, obviously.
He never turns around to the real doll Bianca and says you're a baby, which I think is a missed opportunity.
Yeah, that's true. It's pre-baby.
it's a great performance. I think he gets a lot of credit for performances in more popular films such as The Notebook and things like that, but I think this is a superior Gosling performance.
Yes, it's vastly superior to The Notebook, but it's dealing with much better material. And, you know, obviously his performance in The Notebook is one of the few things that sort of makes it just about watchable. But, yeah, he's great. And again, it shows a versatility to his performance that I think a lot of actors don't have. You know, he could do this, but he can also do Drive. He can also do The Nice Guys. He can also do La La Land. Like, it's quite a varied CV that he's got. And you get the feeling that he has a sharp mind because he takes on things that are interesting to him as well. You don't feel like he's just doing any old shit, but at the same time he's not a snob either, because he's done a few relatively silly action films, and that's fine too.
Would you say that this is the movie that turned Ryan Gosling into Ryan Goose?
Yep, this is the Goose Onion catharsis movie. How many episodes have we done? You've been waiting to make that joke since day one.
Yeah, literally.
In fact, did you choose this film just so you could make that joke?
Oh, exactly. That's exactly why I chose it.
Lars and the Real Goose.
Lars and the Real Goose. But yeah, no, I'm a big fan.
Man who falls in love with a goose doll.
I'm a big fan of Ryan Gosling in general. Even the more recent larger budget things like Blade Runner 2049, I think, is a phenomenal film, and I think his performance in that is really good. Oh, dude, get on it. It's so good. It's slow and boring. It's exactly the kind of science fiction film I love.
Sounds great.
Yes, it's beautifully shot. It's one of my favorite movies of last year by far. Ryan Gosling's great in it as well.
Yeah. He's very, very good. I like him a lot.
I like him a lot as well.
Let's see. What else do I have to say about this? I thought the kind of the gradual reveal of why he struggles with intimacy is good as well, because it's only actually about 15, 20 minutes in that you find out about the kind of the parents being dead, and that his mother died when he was born and stuff, and you're like, wow, actually that's kind of massive. But it almost downplays it in favor of actually dealing with the here and now of the trauma, rather than just being like, huge trauma, blah blah blah. Like it's the way it downplays it actually makes it very impactful, I think, because that's another thing that it's exploring, is how people respond to trauma. But no one's coming out of it going, oh, this film like affected me in a huge way. Like, it was really weepy. It was understated, but still managed to explore that in an interesting way.
Yeah, And that's one of the real positives of this film, is the way that it can remain understated like that, even though it's a very strange subject matter and a real sort of like outlandish subject matter. It has this grounding which I really appreciate, and yeah, I think it's great. Really, it's a really good film in that regard. It captures that kind of element of life in a way that very few films can.
Yeah, it's good. I wanted to mention just one other scene when the scene where it really turned a corner in terms of his development of being able to deal with intimacy and become a human a bit more so, is when it's getting on for the end of the film, when his Mackenzie Crook cubicle mate is having a feud with Margot in the office, and he has hung her teddy bear on a noose, and she's very upset, and she comes back and goes, take it off the noose, and he's like, nah, I won't. So then she's off and she's like crying in the break room, and Ryan Gosling decides that this is the point. Actually, he's realized that he empathizes with her, and then goes and sits with her, and he takes the noose off the teddy bear, and then he starts like just quietly, while she's talking, he's just quietly performing CPR on it silently. And it does, that really, really made me chuckle. But that also really illustrated his desire, by at the same time his delusions in terms of attaching life to inanimate objects, whilst also trying to help her as a real person as well. And that scene just like really, really brilliantly turned that corner. But it really made me chuckle when he was performing CPR on the little bear.
Yeah, that was really funny. That scene was actually improvised as well.
Oh, really?
That little CPR scene, which I think is a really clever little moment. And you're right that it works so well because it does capture those two sides of his character in such a brilliant way.
That's cool. Were there any other improvised scenes? Have you got any other trivia? I think it's trivia time.
Oh, yes, it is trivia time. So the scene where Lars and Bianca are about to enter the party was also entirely improvised by Ryan Gosling. Yes. In terms of other trivia, to help Ryan Gosling stay in character, the real doll was treated like an actual person, as is done by characters in the movie. She was dressed privately in her own trailer and was only present for the scenes that she was in.
That's cool. That makes sense.
That's awesome. In terms of other trivia, to eliminate the possibility of any accusation about having sex with the doll, Bianca was custom ordered without any genitalia. And the movie was shot in 31 days.
Wow.
And that's it, which is really impressive.
That's not very long, really.
Yeah, no, that's no time at all.
And I believe the budget was $12 million, which is relatively low for any film, really.
Yeah, that's not a lot of money.
Twice as much as The Room, obviously. But...
oh, dear. And nowhere near as good. Story.
No, obviously. Twice as much money for half the masterpiece.
Oh dear, but yeah, so that'll do for trivia, I think. But yeah, no, it's a really clever little film. I really like it a lot, and I'm pleased that you enjoyed it as well, Paddy.
Yeah, it's very, very intelligent, very good, and deserves a lot more recognition than it got. Very good. How shall we rate it?
That's a tricky one. How many funerals for sex dolls out of 20? Oh, I love it. I love it. Goose meat's not bitter. Goose meat is lovely. Swan meat is bitter, apparently. I had to peel back 15 layers to reach. Yeah, it's a great movie. I sort of take marks away because it's not the kind of film that I feel like you can watch any time. But it's a fantastic film. It's really interesting, great performances, and so it's a feel good movie in spite of everything. It's a feel good film.
Yeah, it washes over you with the good feels, doesn't it? It's not overly stated. It doesn't get your heart pumping. It doesn't make you want to jump out of your seat and pump your fist, but yeah, it washes over you nicely and makes you feel nice at the end. It works its way very, very carefully towards a good catharsis.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, how many onion layers for you then?
My onion has just one extra layer. 16. Again, I feel like it's not quite getting to the top, you know, the top 3-4 category. Just yeah, as you said, just because like you kind of have to be in the mood for it. But yeah, it's very, very good. Very, very well done.
Excellent stuff. It's a great film. I'm glad I was able to watch it again. It's been a while since I last saw it.
And definitely a very, very good contrast to Harry and Meghan, a royal romance.
Yes.
Which was always going to be a tough act to follow.
It was, you know. It just about managed to beat it. Just about.
I mean, yeah, marks off for nobody coming back as a lion.
Yeah, where was Bianca coming back as, like, a ceramic lion?
That would have been an amazing end, actually. Where it's like a few years later and him and Margot have got kids or whatever. It's like a little coda and they're living a happy life. And then there's this lion just like sitting in the corner on a little shelf. And he goes up to her and he's like, have a good day, Bianca.
That would be great. There is a fantastic, well, not fantastic, but a really interesting horror movie called Pin, which is about it's a horror movie about an anatomy doll. Like, you know, those dolls that you have in like doctor's offices and in science classes.
The creepy ones.
Yes.
Where you can pull out the lung and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a really creepy little film. I think it's kind of, it's become a cult classic horror movie now. So yeah, you could have like a horror movie version of Lars and the Real Girl where at the end he's happy there with Margot and then like it's raining outside and then there's a flash of lightning and you just see Bianca there. Standing under a lamplight somewhere.
Yeah, it's just her face at the window, just blankly staring in. Yeah.
That would be amazing. They should have done that, really, shouldn't they?
I'd rather it was her than Prince Philip. Very good. So, are you ready to hear what nonsense I've got for us next?
I am. What nonsense do we have up next, Paddy?
Well, I was going to go with a sort of more classic film, but then I switched on the Amazon Prime yesterday and spotted that a film that's been sort of bothering the film charts for the last few months has now come onto streaming, which is The Greatest Showman.
Oh, cool. Okie dokie.
So it's interesting for a number of reasons. I've actually already watched it. We watched it last night. I won't say anything, but I thought it was one that we should talk about because it sort of didn't do that well at first, but then the word started to get around and it got to number one in the UK cinemas on its sixth week of release, which is like unheard of. And then they started doing sing-along versions and it got really popular because of the soundtrack and stuff, which is the thing that's becoming more apparent these days with people trying to write original musicals and stuff. And I think, I'm a sucker for musicals and I find them very interesting. And I think there's a lot of interesting stuff to discuss around it. So that's going to be our next one. I'll be very interested to see what you make of it. But I won't say anything about it for now.
Cool. No, looking forward to watching it.
Although, obviously, it can't top Hugh Jackman as Jean Valjean.
No, but, you know, can it top Russell Crowe as Javert? That is the question. No,
because nothing will ever top Russell Crowe as Javert. Yeah. Greatest Showman, not out of 20, not enough bellowing.
Not enough. Oh yeah, okay. I'll need to get Les Mis out of my head before I watch it, because otherwise I'm just gonna sit there going, not enough Russell Crowe. Where's all the Russell Crowe?
I'm waiting, guys. Come on, bring the crow.
Oh dear.
All right. Do you have any other bits of follow up or anything?
I don't. I don't know if you do.
No, I was going to talk about Jordan Peterson, but I feel like we've talked about him enough. All we need to say is that he's the worst.
Yeah, I the only thing I'll say about that then is that I give it 5 years before he started his own cult.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's basically there already.
Yeah.
I think 5 years is being optimistic. So like, the way that people respond to him is very culty.
Yeah, so I think legitimate cult within 5 years.
Yeah, that sounds good.
That sounds great.
I do have his book here though, and I went to the back and looked at, there's an index, so I looked up dogs and I've gone to the first reference to dogs. I'm just gonna do a quick live reading. Even dogs must be socialized if they are to become acceptable members of the pack. And children are much more complex than dogs. You heard it here first, boys.
Children are much more complex
children
than dogs.
Children are much more complex than dogs.
Oh my God. He's...
Mind blown.
He's the intellectual of our generation, Paddy.
Yeah.
What a voice.
The hero that we deserve. So, yeah. Regular feature. Jordan Peterson is still very, very bad.
Can we do a little live reading? Just a little snippet like that every week.
Yeah. You choose something from the index and I'll find a thing.
Excellent.
I'll go to the page. Oh, there's an entry on vengeance.
Oh,
wanting.
Vengeance.
Willful blindness has about 10 sub entries.
God.
Revenge, see vengeance.
that's the name of the next Nicolas Cage movie, isn't it?
See vengeance. that's someone's name, like the letter C and then vengeance.
Yes, exactly.
His name's like Christopher Vengeance, and he's a cop. He's a bad cop.
Although apparently Nicolas Cage is going to be in a good film.
That's never happened.
Well, it hasn't happened in about 15 years, has it? Apparently this film called Mandy.
Mandy.
Yes.
I haven't heard of it.
So it's supposed to basically be like a sort of exploitation flick, like in the 70s and 80s. So super violent, silly, pretty looking horror action film. And apparently it's very good in terms of pre-release. It's been getting quite a lot of good support. It's from the guy who directed Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is like a wonderful pastiche to Stanley Kubrick, filmed in a very similar manner and has a similar kind of dystopian 80s science fiction vibe to it. And so yeah, apparently it's people who've seen it so far say it's very, very good.
Wow. Okay. That sounds all right.
Yeah, so yeah, we may well have a good Nicolas Cage movie to talk about at some point soon.
The first one since Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
Yeah, I mean, nothing's going to top that. it is the greatest film ever made, so yeah. Going to have difficulty topping that one.
The peak of cinema.
Oh, dear.
Oh, good times. Okay, well, I think we can leave it there, but if you like what we do, as always, drop us an email, bigboysdon'tcrypodcast@gmail.com. Tweet us at bigboysdon'tpod. Always love to hear from you. What did you make of Lars and the Real Girl? Have you ever had a relationship with an inanimate object? You know, how did it go for you? How many layers does your goose onion have? You know, these are important questions and we want your input. And if you like what we do, please leave us a rating or a review on whatever podcast platform you use. Always helps. Helps us to keep doing this. And keep bringing you this quality content.
Yes, yeah. If you have any inanimate object love stories, please let us know.
That could become like a regular column.
Yes, yeah. I fell in love with my toaster. That kind of thing.
It was a brave little toaster.
Oh, dear. Anyway, goodbye, everybody.
Alrighty. We'll be back next week to talk about The Greatest Showman.
All right, bye.
All right, bye.